All right. Welcome everyone to the final installation of the MSE All Hands Meeting remote version, such as it is. We've had some really excellent talks in the last three telecons that we've held throughout the month of October. And we're looking forward to hearing some more about advances in the MSE project planning today. Today we're focusing on the software, the data with MSE and the software associated with it. So we will hear from Key talking about the progress on the PISA software, the control software for the whole project, every aspect of it. Sam's gonna talk to us about his recent work on calibration systems for MSE. And we're happy to have Stephanie Juneau here to talk about how Noir Lab will hopefully someday be able to help us with handling the MSE data products once they're produced. And then at the end, Alan's gonna give us a inspirational short talk about reminding us about everything that we've heard from the telecons throughout the month. So with that, let me just hand over the floor to Key. And I, as we just discussed, I'll give you a warning after 15 minutes.
Thanks, Jennifer. Just gonna turn on my video. All right. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on you're connected.
You say good night.
Yeah, well, hopefully you stay awake. Okay, so I'm just gonna talk about, like Jennifer said, PISA, what we call Program Execution Software Architecture, what it really is, product definition, and how it is complement or compatible to observing workflow. Just highlight the key functionality of the products and also how the work is being organized now. So what is PISA? So if you think of it as a black box, it is really a software set that generates science data product, taking the proposal, cranking it through, and then out come the science data product. And then that the architecture actually follow what I call a typical observing workflow. So starting from proposal selection to target definition, observation, and then once you get data, you reduce it, you validate it, and then you distribute it. So just want to highlight, it is the MSE plan to deliver reduced and vetted data science product to the community. So it's going to be sort of science ready. So if you look at the different, product and they can be kind of organized or structured into two main categories, what we call pre-observation and then post-observation, and separated by a separate product, which is not part of PISA, but is what we call the Observatory Execution Software Architecture. So this is another suite of control software. It's also control hardware that execute observation and then do the associated calibration exposures. So this is sort of the dividing line between pre and post observation. And OESA also contain all the what I call the IT infrastructure of MSE as well. The computer, the network, the server, et cetera. And then within each category, so there's sort of three groups of products according to their functionality that I will kind of go over next, which is, you know, one is for survey preparation definition, one for data reduction pipelines, and one for science archive and platform. So conceptually, there are 10 products. So starting with proposal review. So this is the user interface for PI to submit the proposal and for the survey selection committee to review them. So the information of the proposal and also a sample target list are uploaded to the what we call the object model. So every target is defining the object model. We call it an observing element. And the information about the proposal and the target can be accessed through so customized application programming interfaces, or API. So when the proposal been selected, so the survey team upload the entire sort of target list, definition, and maybe observing condition and constraint and such. And then the scheduler extract that information from the object model and then perform real time and long term optimization of how the fiber allocated to targets as well as telescope pointing. So this is what we call the schedule. So that's transferred to the breaker, which translate the observation defined by the scheduler into command that OESA can understand and then execute the observation. And once the observation is finished, so the detectors are read out. So they're in sort of what we call the raw 2D format, and then the data calibration would generate 1D spectra by combining the science and the calibration exposures and then produce the official science product. So this is what we call level 0, level 1, and level 2 product, which I'll describe a little more later on. We also envision there'll be a science pipeline, taking the sort of the basic fundamental product level 1 and level 2. There'll be more recipe or analysis to add value to those products in the pipeline, and we call that level 3. I'll talk about that more later as well. So during that process, the object model will receive feedback from the data reduction and pipeline, and then each target, the status will be updated and then tracked in the object model until the observation of that target is complete. What else? Yeah, and then the information, once it's completed, is forwarded to the repository, the science archive. It will hold all the science information, the science data product information, as well as the archive would also control the access right of the user in the community according to the permission they have. And then we envision information we access through the science platform, which will also provide visualization and an analysis tool sort of to enable scientists to work more efficiently. I should mention the exposure time calculator, which the scheduler access when it's sort of planning observation, because it provides estimate of exposure time to reach SNR required for each target. So that's help the scheduler using that to do scheduling. And then there is an end-to-end simulator. So it really model or account for all the physical effect of the system and then provides simulated 2D spectra so that the reduction and the pipeline can use offline or during the development when everything from the front end is not available. And then Sam will be talking more about data reduction later on today. And then Stephanie is going to tell us their work on NOAA Labs' work on the science platform development. So this slide just summarizes how the product is mapped into workflow. So each box here describes the action to be taken and the interface or the tool required to support that actions by the user or by the operator, and where the data or the information is stored, and what part of the PISA product participate in that actions. I'll just go through them one by one. So proposal selection, like I said, PI submit the proposal through a web-based interface into the object model. And then the prop or the proposal review system process that proposal and using the ETC and others, the scheduler to validate those targets, see whether they're feasible. And then once the proposal is approved, the investigator upload their whole set of target definition using either a web access or an API into the object model in the same suite of piece of product will participate. And then go on to observations. MSC will schedule and execute the observation. This is an automatic process, but we will provide tools to the operator so that they can monitor the process and also manage that process in case they want to override something. So that's available. Information is or the observation is updated of each target is updated in the object model. We also envision a parallel repository for all the technical data collected during the observation, which will be the engineering data, the status of all the different observatory system and also telemetry and environmental conditions. So the scheduler and the breaker participate in this action. And then once we get the data, MSC extract and calibrate spectra. Again, a quick look tool will be provided to monitor progress and for quality check of the spectra or of the data. Same repository will be used to store information. And then data calibration and science pipeline will be used to realize this action. And then if we're working offline, then the end-to-end simulator will also be used. So once data is generated, so they will be passed over or passed on to the repository, to the archive, access to the platform, and then that's how the data will be distributed. So just at the bottom, these are the boxes of the three group that I mentioned, and then everything sort of the backbone that contain all the information is in the object model. So just highlight some of the key functionality of each product. So for the proposal review, it is the communication interface that process proposal between the PIs and the survey selection committee. It is a workspace where the proposals are defined, they're received, they're evaluated, and selected. And then it also provide communication between the PI and these survey selection committee, so the PI can query the status of the proposal and then receive notification, you know, whether the SSC need approve the proposal or need more information between them. And it also, the prop also provide a interface with the object model so that to facilitate target and observing condition definition upload by the survey team. So once a proposal is selected, a survey team will be formed with membership, the PI, the scientists working in that proposal, as well as a MSC science staff member will form that survey team. Scheduler will generate optimal schedule based on target list, target priority in the object model. In the object model, yeah. So we envision the object model will contain thousands of targets, about a million. The target will be in various stage of completion because we'll be doing a parallel survey at any single exposure or telescope pointing. And then the scheduler will control parameters such as telescope pointing, fiber to target allocation, as well as spectrographic configuration. As you know, there will be two suites of spectrograph, LMR, low model resolution spectrograph, and then HR, high resolution spectrograph. Each spectrograph can be configured because it have different wavelength arms, so each arm can be configured with different integration or exposure interval, for example. And then the low model resolution spectrograph can be configured for different spectral resolution as well. So there's kind of a lot of moving parts in the scheduler. And the scheduler maintain a forward-looking schedule to forecast survey completion, as well as a short-term nightly schedule that is updated or revised dynamically based on condition or the observing conditions, such as seeing or environmental condition. And then the scheduled access ETC to estimate exposure time required for the targeted SMO. Exposure time calculator, as mentioned already, is an SMO or exposure time based tool. It will be modular in design, so we can swap out a module as subsystem being revised, and that really facilitates future upgrade. The breaker is the communication interface translating high level schedule observing command into sort of hardware dependent observatory control system command between the two. So it's an intermediate communication layer so we can actually update the scheduler or the OESTA independently if we need to. And that offer that upgradability as well. Science calibration, so apply calibration to convert the raw 2D detector readout, what I call level zero, into 1D spectra, also level one, level two. So it will use a homogeneous calibration algorithm, so to produce consistent level one, level two science data product. We envision there'll be two sets of algorithm, one for LMR, one for HR, or optimize for LMR and for HR. Our science pipeline, so generate enhanced level three science product provided by the survey team with added scientific value, such as the pipeline will stack spectra from separate exposure, for example, provide measurement of blind flux, redshift, etc.
Hey, you have about 5 minutes left.
Thank you. All right. Thanks. So Science Archive, so it is a storage and repository for science data product of all level. It managed community access according to their permission or data access rights. And then finding the science platform, it will facilitate access to the archive and provide visualization and analysis too, to enable scientists to process the data and also publish the data in a timely fashion. Potentially, the platform could have prearranged or prefer access to other data sets, so the scientists can do multi-wavelength, multi-facility study through the science platform. Last but not the least, the end-to-end simulator it simulates system performance by presenting 2D spectra delivered from the detector. It supports the science calibration and science spectrum development when things are the real data are not available, and also just support ongoing development by allowing offline testing and verification of future upgrade. So I showed this slide at the very first talk, and then how originally we were going to do this work by having all the product working in parallel with different groups. But after talking to our advisory council, they just said, let's just do it one step at a time. So do a system level development or conceptual system level development of all the product as a whole, so that we understand the data flow, the data structure, and also the interface between the products. And also the project office realized we need to support Jennifer's work on this, the science reference survey developments with the science team. So we need to provide a ETC and a scheduled prototype for her to do this work. So today, I'm happy to report that Christian Surab from LAM in Marseille, he has agreed to be the group one lead in this overall system conceptual design development. Christian will be working remotely from France, bringing his leadership experience in CSAM, which is the Astrophysical Data Center of Marseille. the group that is leading there. And just to sort of reiterate the objective of group one, so having my project manager hats on is really to set the scope and the deliverable of PISA based on the community expectations, so that that just allow us to better understand what needs to be done going forward with PISA. Yonghe University in South Korea is group two. They'll be responsible for the exposure time calculator prototyping. And then as for the scheduler prototype, so we're in discussion with potential contributor. So we have yet to find a group three yet. So it's just sort of just awesome. Just throw it out there. If any group you know or in the audience is interested, please contact Jennifer or contact I. I would like to talk about scheduler prototype development. So that was my last slide. So I will stop here. And I guess we wait for questions at the very end, Jennifer?
No, sorry, I should have said that at the beginning. So we'll have about 5 minutes for questions in between talks, so people can ask questions of the previous speaker, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion as well at the end. Okay. So do we have any questions for Key?
Yeah, I've got one. So if Christian is leading the PISA bit, is there anybody else involved?
Yeah, so there'll be a group doing that. I think we kind of left it. We need to go back and talk to the we have contacted you for everyone. Yeah, so we have contacted a group of potential members of group one, and we need to go back and reconnect with them and let them know what's happening. Yeah. So he's not the only one doing the work. The short answer.
Okay.
Nick, I can respond to the question that you asked me in the chat also. So we're, as Key said, we're very excited that Christian has stepped up and is looking forward to leading this effort. He doesn't start officially for 2 weeks or something like that. So I expect that one of the first things he'll do is contact the software teams that have expressed interest in PISA in the past and start getting reorganized in the way that he wants to organize things since Nicola has left and is no longer leading this. And so again, stay tuned for next steps, probably within the next month, I imagine he'll start that conversation.
Yeah. No, I think that's super useful. You've got Christian to lead that. And I think having a French group for this is really handy as well, just from the sort of geopolitical things.
Well, and they have a lot of relevant experience. So we're looking forward to seeing them apply. Yeah.
I'll say we're still pretty keen to be involved in that, though.
Excellent. That's good to know. And we will certainly remind Christian of that.
Right. Great.
Stephen Gwynn here. One point we'll discuss with Nicola, the archive part was going to be handled by the CDC. Is that, as a sort of baseline plan, is that changed? Is the archive now going to be at the in Marseille or what? Or should I be talking to Christian to find out what's going on?
Nothing's been changed, Stephen. So it's just that we need to get organized.
We've kind of just paused while we let our new coordinator get up to speed and start the conversation again. So I don't think we've gone back on any decisions or discussions that we've had in the past.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a decision. There was just a sort of a, yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah, and we will certainly, again, remind, just like as Nick said, we'll remind him of everyone's interest.
Great.
Any other questions for Key? All right, and as I said, we'll have time for discussion at the end. So if things come up, don't hesitate to ask. Let's move on. So thank you, Key, for a good summary of what's going on with PISA. Let's move on to Sam's presentation about the calibration plans for MSE. Sam, I'll give you 5-minute warning again, like I did to Keith.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm assuming you're seeing the slides. First of all, I want to say it's a great pleasure for me to have recently joined this exciting project, and it's wonderful to see several familiar names in the audience. A shame that we can't meet in person this year, but hopefully soon. So I'm the systems engineer for MSE, and so I tend to take a holistic viewpoint on things. And so my calibration overview is going to be from that perspective, not just focused on data reduction, data calibration itself. I'm looking at the overall calibration aspects, and I'm hoping that this does build upon the work that Alan and others did, where they presented a really nice overview paper at the last SPIE talking about procedural methods with the data. So I'm including in here the calibration of both the facility and the science. I'm going to gloss over the facility quite a bit because of lack of time. So that's where I consider it's a subsystem that needs to be optimally performing to get the light optimally down the fibers. And then there's the science calibration, which feeds into the data reduction side of things. There's a variety of mitigation strategies. Ideally, we want to mitigate all of the calibration issues by design. We want to build something that requires the minimum amount of calibration. We then, want to be able to detect things that are out of calibration or how to get them into calibration. We will have by procedure, so that's by telescope pointing, et cetera. We will have by calibration where we take reference flats and such. We will do modeling and apply the models to fine tune the data processing, which comes into play as well. So why do we concern ourselves with calibration? Well, we have a large aperture doing spectroscopy, 80 square meter collecting area. And we also have an excellent site. So we want to be able to take advantage of those two things. That makes MSE unique compared to all the other facilities that will be coming online on a contemporaneous timescale. So we need to have calibrations that are robust, optimal, and ideally correct. So as I said, facility calibrations are things like making sure the M1 segments are calibrated and in proper alignment and performing optimally so that light is coupling into the fibers in an optimal fashion. Telescope pointing, the technical cameras, astrometric calibration is a critical one to make sure your fibers are actually landing on your targets to within the required precision. And then we need to have our spectrographs focused and the shutters calibrated. So these will all be done at the various work package levels for those related subsystems. They will propose the methodologies for maintaining the calibrated performance over the lifetime of the facility. For science calibration, so that's calibration necessary to ensure that the spectra actually represent the true nature of the target spectra that we're trying to measure for the science. And so there's a range of classes of calibrations, and this is what was covered in Alan's SPIE paper. We have detection sensitivity, we have background calibration, we need to calibrate the wavelength, we need to calibrate the PSF of the spectra. And I'm adding in that we also need to be aware of spurious contamination. We don't want to say, hey, we've got a funny looking spectrum here, let's write a paper on it when it's caused by some other non-target related source. So detection sensitivity, we need to determine the relative sensitivities of the pixel to pixel on the detector. We need to keep in mind that detector pixels themselves may have a variation in sensitivity across their face. So we have to make sure our calibration accommodates that. And we also need to get our target to target sensitivity between fiber to fiber, because we have a variety of sources that will cause issues and errors in that uniformity. I'm skipping over these pretty quickly. This is going to be on the website, so please go back to this presentation to look at the details that are on the slides. So anyway, so calibration methodologies for sensitivity are illumination of the focal surface with dome flats or some similar thing, illumination of the detector to do detector flats, or sometimes they're called milk flats, and then looking at spectrophotometric standards to scale the flux accordingly. Background calibration. So we need to be able to calibrate out things like just the sky background, the emission line, and the continuum of the sky. Ghosts, those are reflections from optics and structures. Scattered light in the spectrograph from optical surfaces and such. And then also, you know, the bad pixels and thermal background play a role. Sky background. So there's a variety of sources for potential background. On the left are basically high frequency events, both temporally and spatially. One thing I'm trying to understand right now is what level we might be impacted by sprites, elves, and ghosts from thunderstorms. These structures are above the storms and go up to heights of 100 kilometers. So if you have a storm 100 kilometers away, your sprites will be at a 45 degree elevation angle with respect to that. That could potentially be a problem if MSE is pointed in the direction of a thunderstorm. There's other, you know, like aurora, we're at an equatorial location. So those are minimal, but at the 25th magnitude level, I don't know what contributors there are. We all know that OH emission varies as a function across the field and on time scales, so that needs to be accounted for. Clouds introduce variability. Hopefully we avoid the laser contamination from neighbors on Mauna Kea by procedure. There's light pollution, especially from Hilo. And then in the night sky, we have zodiacal light, Gegenschein, moonlight, and twilight that play a factor in contributing to the sky background that we need to calibrate out. So we must sample the collective signal across the field. MSE is not an imager, it's a discrete imager. We can take advantage of that at some level, but it's still missing certain spatial characteristics that we might need to monitor separately. And calibrations must be contemporaneously so that we can deal with temporal behavior. And we also must understand the spectral characteristics. So one of the things that I'm introducing is the possibility of having imagers monitor the sky as we're taking data to collect the information that we need. Ghosts and scattered light. So there's ghosts at the telescope focus from the wide field corrector, and there's ghosts and scattered light within the spectrograph itself that we need to worry about. There's three specific ghosts of concern with our corrector design. There's a strong image ghost, there's a moderately strong pupil ghost, and then there's a very sharp and strong image ghost at the outer edge of the field. We were exploring mitigation by design. It doesn't look like that's feasible, and so likely we'll have to do it by procedure where we avoid placing bright stars in those areas. I tried to make a video showing the simulation, but I couldn't get to work, so we'll step through. This is with a bright source, the equivalent of a zeroth magnitude at the field center. And here's this ghost one. You can see it, it's this bright one here. As the star moves off center, that ghost moves to the right and quickly goes off the field of view. These are two reference signals I have in here. This is at 20th magnitude, and this is at 25th magnitude. So this is basically indicating the level that we want the ghost to be below for it not to be of much concern. So that's ghost one. Then we have a region, an annulus, where there aren't really any ghosts of concern. Until we get out to here, then we have ghost two coming in. This is this pupil ghost, and it grows in size. And as you can see, it's below the limit of the sky, but it's above what we want our threshold to be. And it's covering much more, a larger extent on the field. And as the star keeps going to the side, it continues to grow, but it is diluting itself. And then we reach a point where ghost three at the outer edge of the field comes in, which again is an image ghost and very bright, but impacts very small area of the field. And eventually that ghost falls off the side of the field, and ghost two eventually dilutes to where it's below the threshold of concern. So if we mitigate by procedure, so by telescope pointing or by target configuration, this is an initial look at what that would need to be. So we have this center region where we need to avoid stars brighter than 9th magnitude. There's a lot of stars there. So it's unlikely we'll mitigate all the ghosts by that way. And so if a star has to be positioned in this part of the field, then we need to be wary of where that ghost is. And so that maybe we don't assign targets to that region, or at least faint targets. Out here in this annulus with the pink and the light blue, that's where the pupil ghost comes into play when the stars are within this annulus. Fortunately, the magnitude range is much brighter. So basically it's third to second magnitude, maybe fourth magnitude stars we have to be concerned about, but there's a lot fewer of those. So perhaps we can mitigate completely those ghosts by avoiding placing stars in those regions. Then there's this region where the third ghost comes in. And again, that's bright, faint stars. So there's a lot. It's unlikely we can mitigate all of them. But fortunately it's an image, very tight image ghost. We then just need to be aware of its location and make sure we don't have any targets assigned in that region. Ghosts and scattered light in the spectrographs. So we're moving to an Eschel high-res design. This is just a reminder. So these are images of the STIS Eschel. So it is older, maybe it's older technologies, but there are is a an enormous background introduced by Eschel scattering and ghosting that will need to be accommodated for within the data reduction and calibrated out in some fashion. And over here on the right, this is the infamous recombination literal ghost of VPH gratings. This is from the Hermes spectrograph, again, where since the grating was used in litro, there's this bright ghost that needed to be modeled. For us, we're trying to mitigate that by tilting the fringes and introducing a non-literal configuration. Wavelength calibration. So basically, you know, we need to keep in mind that the HR spectrograph, we require a tenth of a kilometer per second velocity measurements. So that's a hundredth of a resolution element. We're not in the exoplanet regime, but we are still in a very high precision level regime. And so all these factors need to be worried about and calibrated out in some fashion. PSF calibration, basically, I just want to remind people, it's not just the spot diagrams that the optical designers provide. It's also the physics of the optical system. So this is Hermes, and the images are blurred by a combination of the spot diagram and also of the anamorphic distortions caused by the gratings.
Sam, you have about 5 minutes left.
Okay, I'll try to make it through. Spurious contamination. So basically, satellites is on everybody's mind. So I did a back of the envelope. I hope this is more or less correct. I did a comparison with, I think, what DESI came up with, and it seems to be in the ballpark. So this is an analysis based on 50,000 satellites. And the bottom line is basically I compute that 4% of MSC targets will be impacted by satellites on an hourly basis. And that over a decade of MSC, that's the equivalent of greater than 100 lost nights of science or a few million targets impact. So this is at a level that I think we should be concerned about. The magnitude level is also quite, we need the satellites to be actually quite faint. This is much fainter than I think the NOAA Labs report has indicated. And this is something that I think we should follow up on. So basically—
quick question, Sam. Is the spectral, are they, what's their spectral response like? Is it fairly gray or do they just specifically hit, contaminate some lines or some bits of the spectrum?
Well, at the first order, it would be solar.
Yeah, because it's reflected solar light, yeah. Okay, thanks.
So anyway, so here are mitigation strategies. If we know the orbits, we can avoid assigning targets to them, and we want to try and do that. Also, I believe we want to monitor the field and watch to see whether or not there were any satellites that passed through. And then, the more exposures we take per field, the less the impact is. There's the other thing that with that ghosting, we do have to worry about satellite flaring also being an impact. So we're just now starting up the SCAL work package. And so this is basically a breakdown of the componentry that's envisioned for doing calibrations, that the associated calibration of that component, and then the responsible party, likely responsible party. So Texas A&M, Darren DePoy, Jennifer and Luke Schmidt are gonna take on the SCAL specific responsibility of designing the hardware, at least that goes on the telescope. And then identifying hardware that may need to go inside other subsystems, such as for the pixel flats, which might be items within the spectrographs. So I've got here a variety of, basically this just, everybody knows what this is. Flat field lamps are a set of continuum lamps in a screen or some way of illuminating. It's needed basically for every configuration, the same for wavelength. Simultaneous calibration, that's something I think we need to seriously consider, especially for the high-res spectrograph for that velocity requirement. And that can either be done with a set of dedicated fibers that are illuminating the detector with wavelength calibration simultaneously as the target spectra, or one could consider implementing an absorption cell. I personally favor item one because the absorption cell has other issues, but I seriously think that that should be something that's considered. And again, I'm suggesting that we consider target field imagers. I think these can be small enough that they mount on the telescope. You don't need to monitor every single wavelength band, but you want to monitor a few so that you can tie that to your spectral modeling and make sure that the modeling is going correctly. Calibration lamps, detectors, so these are the things that might reside in the spectrographs. It's probably an infrequent calibration, but it's still needed for ensuring that we understand the linearity of the detectors and the pixel-to-pixel variations. For PSF calibration, we probably want a way to mask off or illuminate single fibers at a time. So there's a couple ways of doing that with either projectors on sky observations or slit masks. And then there's, of course, the on-sky calibration targets. And by procedure, avoiding target assignments and such. And then the modeling and calibration pipelines that the PISA work will do. So, you know, and Andrea Petrick is exploring developing a Mauna Kea sky model to be part of that. And I think all of these tools, when combined, we will be able to meet the demands of extracting spectra that are as representative of the true spectrum that we want. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Sam. There's a couple of questions in the chat, but let me see if there's anyone wants to interject before we get to those.
I have one question, Jennifer. This is Danielle. Sam, in your satellite estimation, did you consider Starlink satellite constellations, or did you just use some satellite parameters? Because there's seven magnitude, and they go across the field pretty fast. And I calculated that the for MegaCam that they were not that bad at saturating the whole array when they come in, but with the fiber size that you have, they will be on your fiber about 10 times longer, more or less, than with MegaCam. So have you taken that into account?
Basically, I assumed 50,000 satellites uniformly distributed across the sky and in two-hour orbits. In reality, it's going to be maybe slightly worse than that because they're not completely scattered across the sky, but it's a good first order. And I got with a two-hour orbit, I get a dwell time of 6/1000ths of a second on a fiber. And
that sounds about right. Yes.
Yeah, and that's what led me to that. They need at 24th magnitude, they need to be fainter than 10th, 11th magnitude. Otherwise, they will leave an imprint.
Oh, okay. I know they got them back down from 5 to 7. And I think getting them down further is going to be extremely hard for them. So.
Yeah, what I don't know, now, of course, when they pass through the Earth's shadow, but even then, they're illuminated by Earthshine, from moonlight. They're never black in the sky. And I think, this clearly needs to be factored. I want to call the term the must factor of what's the impact on your instrument. The must factor is 4% for us. And, when you multiply that by the value of the instrument, that's, $8 million-ish impact on the scientific return. So
Sam's going to send Elon a bill for that.
Yeah.
Andy, you have a question?
All right. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, I do. I have a different ghost question. So, thanks for that very illuminating talk, Sam. I'm particularly surprised and concerned about ghost number 2 because it covers such a large portion of the field of view. So I guess my question is what your assumptions were for the AR coatings on the corrector, and you know, whether you think there's any possibility that we're gonna, you know, possibly get anything better. I mean, are you using salt gel coatings?
So yes, I used the nominal coatings that I understood to be our baseline. Mm-hmm. Now that might not be correct, but I assume mag fluoride salt gel on the inner lenses, so L2 to L5, and mag fluoride on L1, both the outer and the inner. It's the outer surface of L1 that is a contributor to both ghost to ghost two, mm-hmm. to that pupil ghost. And since that's the external surface, I assumed it might be risky to do salt gel there for the, you know, over the lifetime of the instrument. It's something we can explore. Certainly, you know, a factor of two improvement in the AR coating is an enormous benefit to suppressing the ghost. So yes, I this is something that we need to look at, but I did try to take a fairly conservative and realistic approach here. The bandwidth of the spectrograph sort of prevents us from going with high performance multi-layer coatings,
right?
Because we're going, you know, so wide, and then the size of the optics. That's something to still keep an eye on, whether or not any vendors can do such coatings, but I'm dubious.
So do you think, based on your analysis, that this should be upped in the list of priorities for, you know, early engineering analysis and work?
I've been hammering that this is a concern of mine, especially if we want to lock down the wide field corrector optical design. I know that with Foremost, we had at least that ghost one, the one that rapidly moves off, and we decided to mitigate it by data analysis and procedure, basically. To be honest, we never really explored the other ones, but we're also not pushing Foremost was not pushing quite as faint because it's a 4-meter telescope. But here, I think, it's something that we need to keep an eye on. We need to be exploring how best to mitigate this. We need a scheduler, a person to look at what impact do these zones have on.
Yeah, how often is this a problem?
Yeah, how often is it a problem? How often can you avoid it, and how often are you going to take a hit that you then need to know? The other thing is, you know, I'm not convinced that you can predict where the ghosts are exactly, unless you do a lot of as-built imagery. We can provide regions of avoidance and zonal impacts, area impacts of ghosts, but we probably have to have a buffer around them, because you need to look at what does the ADC do to shifting it. And
well, the other issue is that the pupil that's illuminating that ghost rotates, and you've just done an instantaneous picture. So I don't know if that makes it easier or harder for you when you smear out the structure in that pupil. That's a thought. My other question, since I'm talking, I hope I'm not hogging too much of it, but does anybody know how well the thorium-argon reference source is working for GHOST? So I think this is exactly the analogous to what you're alluding to have an onboard spectral reference.
Well, it could either be thorium-argon, but or a modulated continuum source, you know, either a laser cone or a etalon type of thing. That's what Foremost is.
That's what Foremost decided on. Yeah. An etalon or a.
I think it's an etalon, I believe.
You're referring to the ghost spectra for Gemini, Andy?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So, I mean, the internal reference source to that is, I think it's thorium xenon. But anyway, it's implemented and it's good. But the problem with ghost right now is it's worked incredibly well in the lab, and it got put in its shipping containers, and it got shipped to Gemini, and then the world changed.
Oh, it's not on the telescope yet. So it's sitting, waiting to go to the telescope.
It's essentially waiting for
the nations
of Canada, Australia, the US and Chile to think it's safe to commission it. So yeah,
that was my real question, if we had any on-sky data. So
no on-sky data, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I think we should move on to Stephanie's talk. But Sam, I just want to point out that Stephen Gwynn made a good suggestion in the chat, if you want to take a look at it, about adjusting exposure times according to weather.
Yep. Yeah. Right. No, it's another good reason for having a monitor.
Yeah. All right, Stephanie, you want to?
Yeah, I'm going to start. And,
like I said, I'll give you a warning after 10 minutes. You can have a couple more minutes after that if you need it.
Okay, sounds good. I'm going to put a timer just to see. All right. So hi, everyone. Thanks for having me today. I'm pretty happy to tell you about what we've been doing at NOAA Lab. So what I'm going to do is basically present what we have now and some ideas of future directions. And mostly so far we've been using SDSS and we're preparing for DESI, but a lot of it would be directly applicable to MSC. So I think it's pretty exciting. So let me get started here. So I'll give a brief reminder about the Astro Data Lab. So why the Data Lab was created in the first place was motivated by the rise of big data in astronomy, and in particular, big photometric surveys, so the dark energy survey, the dark energy camera, because suddenly the survey were giving rise to a lot of images, but also a lot of catalogs for users to be able to do a lot of research. So the Data Lab is one of the pillars of NSF's NOAA Lab, part of the Community Science and Data Center. And when I say big data, what I mean is that we're starting to get now in the range of having petabyte scale data sets. So it's no longer convenient to download all the data. So instead we need to basically bring the analysis to the data. And the goal of this is to have a lot of diverse research, because a given survey, for example, the dark energy survey is like a survey that can study galaxies, stars, and this even I think studies of the solar system objects. So it's really, the idea is to maximize scientific output. And I think this is relevant for MSC as well. And this is the goal of the lab as a science platform, is also to enable teams or individuals, but really at all scales. So what we need to make this work is to have a lot of data sets that are co-located, but with also tools to analyze them jointly or separately. And in a sense, we're reaching sometimes the limit now with these kind of more data intensive research, where the science potential becomes defined by the software capabilities. So excitedly, we now include spectroscopic data and services. So this is what I'm going to tell you about in the next few minutes. So for spectroscopic data, so far we have a copy of all of SDSS. So this is all the catalogs, spectra, and images. So we have all the files. In addition to the files, we made some databases, ingested files into tables. And we only did this so far for some selected data releases of SDSS, and also for selected files. So for example, the latest data release is the R16, in particular, the main spectroscopy table, which is like object, but we also have a lot of value-added catalogs that are really useful for science. So they could have like stellar masses of galaxies or a lot of other quantities. And also some of them are multi-wavelength pre-matched to SDSS. Other spectroscopy data, we have now our first Gemini LLP, the Large and Long Program, Go Green. So we have a couple of also all the files. And I'm not putting it on the slide, but we also have a database that allows to query the tables from the survey. And what we're preparing, so we started already DESI. So DESI is the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. We already have the catalogs and images. And in the future, when they become available, we'll be serving the spectra. So I'll tell you more about DESI in the next slide, but just to say a bit more about the future, we also have plans and we're discussing to have other copies of Gemini LLPs, and then I guess MSC is why I'm here. Okay, so for DESI, probably most of you are familiar, but it's nice to see the numbers all in one place. So it's a dark energy spectroscopic instrument, cosmology mission. It will map over a third of the sky in order to create the largest 3D map of the universe. So primarily a cosmology mission with 35 million spectra of galaxies and quasars. But in addition to that, there's also going to be a spectra of Milky Way stars. So it was already commissioned, the instrument, but we had to down because of pandemic. However, we are now able to restart, and then we're going to recommission again this is starting soon in November. And we expect the five-year survey to take place between 2021 and 2026. So you have here not a real picture, but you can see the DESI instrument with a spectrograph in the room here installed on the Mayo 4-meter telescope on Kitt Peak. So the DESI instrument is here. Okay, so I told you a little bit about spectroscopic data. Now I'm going to switch gear to the spectroscopic services. So by spectroscopic data, I'm also including here spectroscopic catalogs. So redshift, for example, or spectral feature measurements. Because as part of the science platform, we have them ingested into a database, meaning that the users can then send queries, and they can select subsets, save them, they can join or cross-match the spectroscopic catalogs with other catalogs. So either photometry, or and also it could be multi-wavelength, like we have infrared, and in the future maybe X-ray. A new service that I'm gonna tell you a bit more about in the next couple of slides is spectral access service. So this, as you already saw, you know, considering SDSS has already been going on for many years, there's already ways to access the spectra. It turns out that these ways are fast enough if you're looking at a few to a few hundred, but eventually it starts to be too slow. So I'll tell you about what we've done for this. But very important going forward with the larger and more multiplex spectroscopy surveys such as JESI and MSC to really have a fast access. And then I'll tell you a bit more about also the spectral visualization. So there's two aspects. There's an interactive spectral viewer. So people want to be able to visually inspect the spectra, zoom in, zoom out, and so on. So for this, we're using a version of the Prospect tool, which was designed by the DESI team. And also, we before that, we have been writing a spectral viewer requirements document, which has been a very illuminating exercise. So basically writing down what do we need, what is a top priority features, what can we live without if we have to, and so on. So we have an internal version of that document, but we could possibly share it if you're interested. And then the other way to visualize spectra is to make static plots. So I'll show you also some examples of that. Okay, so the spectral access service, which is one of the novelties at Data Lab, is our spec client. So it takes as input a list of identifiers. So either from a catalog query, could be SDSS plate number, a DESI tile. And then the output will be returned very fast as either an NumPRA or Pandas data frame. And we're also making sure it's compatible with some AstroPy spec utils package. So example, the spectrum Wendy object or FITS files also can be returned. And it's documented in two ways. There's a how-to notebook. This is a Jupyter notebook that shows how to use the spec client to query, retrieve, visualize the spectra, and it's also API documentation. So the test case, this is a bit of a test that was done by Mike Fitzpatrick, who's also online, I believe. So the test was to retrieve 640 co-added spectra from a single SDSS plate. So with Astro Query package for SDSS, this takes about 526 seconds after 23 seconds to run the query. And there's something called AstroML, which takes 491 seconds. The Data Lab file service, so this is at Data Lab, we have the FITS files that takes 249 seconds. And the new spectral access tool is about 1.5 seconds. So much faster, as you can see. And then you can probably ask at the end if you have questions about how this is done. But that was one of the big motivation is because of the large sample size, we want to be able to retrieve spectra very fast. So spectral visualization, first the static cases. So this is part of this example notebook I was mentioning, which is not yet published, but soon. So there's different ways of looking at spectra. There's a quick preview, there's a grid preview. So this quickly will show at a glance a bunch of spectra. And then one could imagine wanting to click on them to look more closely, for example. There's a static spec out, which has a lot of keywords. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but the idea is you can overplot locations of emission lines, absorption lines, the model versus the observed spectrum, and so on. And then the other visualization tool I mentioned before is an interactive viewer. So this is called Prospect. You can see, it's not so obvious, but here's the link on GitHub if you want to see the original Prospect for DESI. This version here that's shown in the screenshot was adapted to be used with SDSS. So in principle, we could also adapt it to be used with MSC Spectra. So the main thing is you can see the data in red with the model overplotted. In principle, one could toggle on and off maybe these emission lines location. This is not doing it here, but I think there's a possibility to add a smoothing. And then the zooming and panning buttons, this is Bokeh, which is the software used to make this plot. But it's also linked to what we call a contextual viewer. So you can see the image of the object whose spectra is shown here. And then one can click on this to go to then the sky viewer and really look at on the sky. So this is from the legacy survey imaging for DESI. But there's a lot of layers on the viewer, which is not shown here at all. If you go on the website here, the legacysurvey.org viewer, you will see, but you can look at unwise and galax and multi-wavelength images as well. So this can help to kind of manually or visually inspect a particular object of interest. I want to show an example science notebook that's based on using this new fast spectral access tool. And this science case is using SDSS spectra of galaxies to create what is called a BPT diagram, which is emission line ratios from the spectra. So the emission lines were already measured. They're in a value added catalog. So we simply query the catalog. From the catalog, you can make a redshift cut, for example, get these measurements, construct a BPT. And in this example notebook, which was written by a graduate student, Raga Pucha in Arizona, she basically designed these four boxes that are four different classes that were pre-classified based on these line ratios. And in each box, the idea is to select 100 random galaxies per box and stack the spectra. So this means that we have four boxes, 100 galaxies each. We need to retrieve 400 spectra and stack each of these regions, which are, then the result is shown here on the right-hand side. So for those familiar, these have an active black hole and they have some pretty powerful emission lines, more striking than in the other category. Blue is like a star forming galaxy that are kind of blue. You can see beautiful spectra, of course, because this is 100 spectra of different objects per bin here.
70 so other couple of minutes left.
Okay. So just to note this, so using our regular file service for the SDSS spectra, so reading the FITS files takes about 7.5 minutes to run the notebook, but it takes 20 seconds with the new Data Lab spectral access service that we have. So looking in the future, so for data access and analysis, we're thinking of using this now faster spectral access to write into have an actual query package to access SDSS on the short term and then DESI on the longer term data. And in terms of analysis of spectra that are already reduced, we want to make sure to be able to remain compatible and maybe help the development of some AstroPy spec utils or other kind of spectroscopy software. The spectroscopic data reduction is not currently within the scope of the Data Lab at NOR Lab. We have some early discussions with the Gemini team, for example, maybe having notebooks that work with their Dragons pipeline. Dragons for now only works for photometry, but in 1 or 2 years, there might be a spectroscopy component, which would be suitable for PI, kind of program reduction. For survey scale reduction, perhaps we could have something like a copy of what DESI is using currently at NERSC, or again, it could be the MSC pipeline reduction. And then the challenges, so I'm going a bit over time, sorry about that. I just want to, I think I'm getting to my close to my last slides here. So current spectral access tools, are they scalable? Then this is what I talked about before. So not really, it was a bit too slow. So that's why we actually had to develop a new service. So now it's much faster. So now, yes, at first the existing tools were not, but the new tool works well for large samples. For spectral reduction analysis tools, I think we still have some work to do there. There's a lot of ongoing effort, and mostly now people are using the Python language. There's not yet, I would say, a complete publicly available replacement of what Araf could do for spectroscopy. So this is ongoing, but it's not yet ready. So this means there's a lot of effort that's still needed to achieve these. And looking toward the future, so we expect several different spectroscopic surveys to come in the next years from highly multiplex instrument. And then you see like a non-exhaustive list here. And there will be always a need for science to connect all these spectroscopy programs with other data sets. So for example, the imaging from the LSST or multi-wavelength. So one can ask a question, what are researchers going to use? Given all these options, what are they gonna do? And also what will achieve the maximum scientific impact from data? So I'm putting these are questions, but actually I think I have the answer. So if we have a lot of these similar kind of data quality, data availability and tools, what will really win the users is having the most user-friendly interface. So you have to have something to back it up. It shouldn't be just user-friendly. You have to have quality software. But given a lot of different good quality software, the difference will be the interface and how users can interact with the archive and the data. So I quickly took a screenshot from Key's talk earlier, but I think thinking about that when developing a science platform is going to be key. So that's all I have. Sorry that I went a bit over time.
That's all right. Great. Thanks, Stephanie. It's really great to see what you guys in Tucson, you and your colleagues in Tucson have been working on since the last presentation you gave at a MSE meeting last February, 18 months ago. Do we have questions for Stephanie? I see one in the chat. So Andrea in the chat asked if the software that you're developing is open source and if she and other researchers can contribute and work collaboratively on developing the codes, or is that, how is that managed?
So the client side with the Data Lab clients on GitHub, and people can install and they could potentially make pull requests on the client side. The server side is not yet public, it's still private. And I don't know if Mike is still online, if he wants to say something about this.
Yeah, I'm here. The intention is that all of the Data Lab codes will eventually be open source, but we haven't released the manager codes for outside collaboration development yet. But certainly in this case, if there's a particular data set or something, it makes sense because the way that the backend services are structured, different data sets are written as subclasses of the main data service. So it makes it easy to write a particular service for MSE versus SCSS versus DESI, and those can be done independently and then just plugged in later on.
Great.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks for the question, India.
Any other questions for Stephanie?
I have one, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Hi, Stephanie. I wonder, I for one would be interested in seeing this requirements document you mentioned.
Me too.
And I think there's probably, I was just going to say there's probably others. I'm sure you've thought about time domain a little, but one of the things we've been thinking about for Sloan 5 is, you know, we'd like to, you know, if we're looking at an object repeatedly, we want to say, show me the sum spectra from everything, but also show me the sum from every month or every individual spectrum. You know, is time domain something you've thought about? A repeat spectra, you know?
So not specifically just for time domain, but the DESI tool called Prospect that I showed is meant to be that you can use it within the JupyterLab environment, and you could ask to see the individual spectra that went into a co-ad spectrum from various nights. So you could display the individual spectra or choose to display the co-ad or display them together. I think that was meant to be a bit also for, you know, data insurance and quality and so on, but it could be applicable for time.
Yeah, as you point out, it's not just time domain. If you're going after a faint galaxy with multiple visits, you want to be able to throw out bad spectra.
Yeah, and that DESI also is reobserving all the quasars that were observed from SDSS. So I think a lot of people will be comparing SDSS and DESI spectra.
Yeah. Thanks.
Great. All right. Thank you, Stephanie. That was great. We appreciate it. All right. So I will turn it over to Alan to give us some inspirational words to wrap up this series of meetings.
Thanks for that. Since this is the last of the four meetings, Jen wanted me to sort of just give a little bit of a summary of where we are and what we've been doing over the last month. And I mean, the first thing is to thank all of you for attending these telecons and also for watching them online. We've been moving around in time zones, of course, because we literally span the world in terms of the consortium. And so again, if you missed any of the four meetings, please do watch them online, and also encourage your colleagues to watch them. I think they've been a very nice update of where we are in the project and what's the things that are going to be really occupying us over the next few years. And indeed, I mean, on that, there's been quite a few new faces over the last year. You've heard from many of them, in fact, or several of them as part of this series of telecons. So we have new science working group leads. It's great to welcome you all. So this is Xiaoting Fu, Ricardo Xivon, Charlie Sakari, Amanda Banerjee, and Chen Xu Li. This is great that you're all there to, again, provide new leadership and new insights into all of these science cases. I mean, these science cases aren't static, right? They keep on changing. And I think that's very obvious now as well as we enter the 2020s and we have things like Weave coming online. You've just heard about DESI coming online. And not least all of the other facilities that aren't spectroscopic, but for which MSC is clearly going to be very closely related. We also heard today from Sam. It's utterly fantastic to be able to draw on Sam's expertise. He's now a systems engineer, and as you see, it's some of the challenges that MSC has in his area are incredibly interesting. A lot of today's discussion was about PESA. So as Jen said, you'll be hearing all of those of you who have expressed interest in PESA, and we'll come on to that a little bit more later. But if you've expressed interest already, we'll be getting in touch, of course. Christian is going to be coordinating a lot of that effort, but of course, everybody's interests are well known and well understood. And also, we had to say goodbye to Nicolas Fagé as he moved on. But we'll be recruiting a new system scientist, and we hope to have some very good news to share about that in the very near future. So again, the project office continues to grow, the collaboration continues to grow. Jen was telling me the science team is now at somewhat over 400 people, which is a daunting number, frankly. And with that as well, there comes a lot more engagement also on the practical side of actually getting this thing designed and built. So in the last, very recently, in fact, we now welcome South Korea to the management group. This is the group of countries, institutes, and consortia who are actually involved in devoting a lot of resources to designing MSE. So we welcome South Korea. Texas A&M transitioned from an observer to a full partner recently as well. Noir Lab and the UK are both observers. I think both of those are new since the last time we had a meeting like this. And indeed, we expect quite a lot of stuff to be happening in the near future. The UK, for example, is actively pursuing ways in which to increase their involvement. And we're very happy to try to help them with that. And of course, importantly, when we talk about engagements and ongoing partnerships, CFHT-MSC, of course, is very engaged in everything that's going on in Hawaii, not just within the CFHT and MSC world, but within the broader astronomy world and within the broader community. You heard about that a lot. In the first meeting, and I think Doug Simons gave a really nice overview of many of the things that are happening there. And so again, this is a role that we all take very seriously, and we look forward to working with everybody to find the best future for astronomy and the best future for the Big Island in particular. Decadal priorities, right? The 2020 being a nice round number has meant that there's a lot of things ongoing which will have a big impact on what countries are doing in the future. And in that, we've been engaged in the Australian Midterm Review, which highlights spectroscopy and MOS spectroscopy as something that they want to stay engaged in. Of course, they have a huge heritage with Hermes and the AAO and lots of work. French Perspective reported last year as well. They do a 5-year plan And again, involvement in CFHT developing into MSE remains a priority for France, which we're delighted. And most recently, as in just a couple of weeks ago, the Canadian Long Range Plan reported its major initiatives or major interests. And we're very pleased to see MSE in there, and indeed some very strong words of support for MSE development. So that's obviously critical. It's just the first step along the way, of course. At the same time, Jen and many of you online have been heavily engaged in ASCRU 2020, the US Decadal Plan. So we expect that to be being reported at some point next year, I think sort of in the spring or thereabouts. There's also particle physics and snowmass, and they take a big interest these days, particularly in a lot of multi-object spectroscopy, particularly with respect to dark energy and cosmology. And already there's a significant component of the cosmology team, of the dark matter team, that are heavily engaged in the snow mass process on MSE's behalf. And then, you know, the last, as you've heard over the last several telecons, there's going to be a lot of work coming up in the next year for MSE. In particular, the readiness review will be a major milestone, and we'll be spending most of 2021 getting organized for that, with a review in late 2021. There's been some significant changes, and as members of the science team, I urge you all to stay engaged with this, because it's really your feedback that helps shape the direction for MSE. One of the things I really like about MSE is there's, I think, a very good relationship between the science teams and the technical teams. And Jen and Key and many others work very hard to make that happen. So for example, because of input from all of you, you were hearing in previous telecons about how a high resolution spectrograph is now notably different in terms of its capability to actually switch the wavelength ranges that it's working in. The low resolution spectrograph, or low and moderate resolution spectrograph, it's also changing its architecture, how it's basically trying to achieve the goals, such that about two thirds of the fibers intended for low resolution go to an optical system, and about one third go to the near infrared. Again, that leads to different observing strategies and different observing modes. And so again, you know, it's really through studying the impact on science that we can figure out if these are the best choices and if there needs to be other changes. And then PESA is really very cool, right? Some of the things that Key was talking about there, you know, the scheduler. I kind of always smile when I see the scheduler box, because it's almost like a miracle happens within this box, because what we're talking about is MSE, you know, obtains Sloan Digital Sky Survey legacy surveys worth of data every 6 weeks or something like that, in terms of the number of targets that it looks at, the number of spectra it looks at. Okay, so how do you schedule something that is only ever doing spectroscopy in all observing conditions, in all seeing conditions, where you're observing millions upon millions of targets per year? How do you schedule that? How do you actually do that efficiently when you take into account all of the types of constraints that you have, both scientifically, in terms of programmatically, in terms of the facility constraints and such like? So that's a really interesting problem. And again, you heard a great presentation there from Sam on all the issues to do with science calibration. And again, MSE views this at this from the sort of holistic level. As Sam said, you know, it's not just in the data reduction. It's elsewhere as well. But I mean, we can't underestimate just how major this is. You know, if you're talking about an object for MSE at 25th magnitude, which is what people want to observe, and your sky is 20 magnitudes per square arc second when it's dark, then you're looking at objects which are quite literally 100 times fainter than the sky, right? So if you're doing sort of 1% sky subtraction, that means half of the flux that remains is from the sky. Okay, so you don't want to be doing science with that. So 1% sky subtraction doesn't cut it. Okay, we need to be reducing that ideally by up to a factor of 10 or thereabouts. And that's really never been done before. We're really pushing the limits here. This is a really critical thing. And it's this type of thing that science considerations are pivotal to. And they're also just really interesting science problems. So again, I think there's a lot of opportunities for people who are interested to have a real contribution here. Because we're doing all of this because this is certainly what I want to see in the future. And Stephanie gave a lovely presentation there about the, you know, the science platform that you could have when you have these types of facilities. I haven't included this other spectroscopic facilities, but I mean, in the future now with Weave, with DESI coming online, they all fit in here as well. But at the largest aperture, MSE is the spectroscopic follow-up and complement to the very large optical telescopes, as we call them in Canada, the TMT, the ELT, the GMT, to your WFIRST, to your Euclid, NGVLA, SKA, Gaia, we know all about, of course, the Vera Rubin Observatory. I mean, this is a tremendous future that we're trying to build. And how we deal with the data is going to be absolutely central to what happens next. So this next year is going to be very exciting. It's exciting to see the developments with PESA. And I would just finish by thanking Jen and all the project office for their coordination of these meetings over the past month. It's not as good as meeting in person, but it is actually still, I think, a very productive and interesting time. With that, I'm not sure if we have time for more general questions. I think certainly anybody in the project office is happy to answer any more general questions that anybody has. But if not, I just like to say thanks to everybody for attending. And please do share these presentations as well with your colleagues online. Thanks.
Thanks, Alan. And let me just say for the record, for people who are watching this online, if you have follow-up questions that you'd like to email to us, you can send them either to me or to the MSE info email address. And we'll answer them to our best of our ability or send them on to the speakers. We have a couple of minutes left. Does anyone have any last minute questions, comments, things to say?
Well, my only comment is that I think this exercise has been really useful and enjoyable. I'm looking forward to doing this next year in person.
Yes, I think we all are. Great, thanks, Andy. Yeah, I agree. I think that these meetings were the best that we could do, but I think they've been maybe more useful than that I had anticipated. And we've gotten a lot of positive feedback. So for other people who have more feedback for us and as I said, questions, comments, discussions going forward, we're happy to hear them and we look forward to hearing from you all. All right. Well, with that, I guess we'll just conclude this month of All Hands Telecon. Thanks everyone who joined in person. Thanks very much to all of the speakers. We heard some great talks throughout the four telecons. And yeah, everyone stay safe and we hope to see you soon.
And really thank you for putting this together. This is, I'm sure it was a lot of work and well worth the effort.
Well, on behalf of the project office, thank you. And it was worth the effort to see all of you.
Thank you, bye.
Thanks, bye-bye.